morning scripture reading will come from Matthew 5, 1 through 3. Matthew 5, 1 through 3. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him and he began to teach them. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Good morning, everyone. I just want to know, we're supposed to have set our clocks ahead 1 hour. I want to know who in the congregation set their clock back to February because all the snow that we got out here and stuff. So somebody did. No, that's supposed to happen. My frogs always get covered by snow the next week or so on that thing. So good to see everybody up. And I know kind of lost an hour of sleep, but it's great to see everybody up and looking up. So looking at me, so hopefully I won't bore you to death too much in there. So we want to stay there in Matthew, the fifth chapter here. And I'm continuing here with a series of stolen lessons on the Sermon on the Mount here and stuff. So, and we look in verse 3, that blessed are the poor in spirit, and theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This part of the sermon starts the Beatitudes that we're looking at there. And it starts off with that blessed are the poor in spirit, they shall theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And if we go down to verse 10, it says, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So we're looking at the kingdom here that Jesus has established. So before I get into poor in spirit, let's look about what this kingdom is here. If we go over, you listen to some folks talk about that one of these days Christ is going to come back on earth and he's going to set up a kingdom in Jerusalem. He's going to sit on the throne and he's going to reign for 1,000 years and we're all going to stay here because that's what Revelations is saying. Even though Revelations is a symbolic book, but there's a lot of folks that think that that's going to happen here. Well, if we go into the book of Colossians real quick, Colossians the first chapter. And it's just saying, talking about Christ, and he says in verse 13, he says, he has delivered us from the power of darkness and conveyed us into the kingdom of his Son, of his love there. He has conveyed it. It's a past tense. The kingdom is not coming. The kingdom is here. And we are to be members of Christ's kingdom here. This kingdom exists right now and stuff. So Christ is king. And Christ is a king not like, say, King Charles of England, where he's kind of not quite ceremonial. I guess he has the right to, if there's a parliament has a tie, he gets to cast a deciding vote in that. But he's kind of a figurehead, and he rules, if anything, but kind of by suggestions or something. So, I think we could do it this way or something. They don't have to follow it, but he doesn't have all of that great power like they had, like kings have had back in the 14th, 15th century and that type of thing there. So he's so he's not a king like a king of England, but Jesus is more like the king like Nebuchadnezzar was a king, or Cyrus was a king. Like whatever they said, that's the rules. He writes something. If he signs a document, that's the law, and you can't overturn it. And his word's law. That's what Jesus is. The kingdom, it's a special relationship with us. A kingdom is a special relationship of law and subjects. It's led by a king who rules. And although this kingdom that we're in now, it's not a physical kingdom. You're not going to look it up on a map and say there's the kingdom that Jesus has established, and here's the borders and this is the passport you're going to need to go through it and stuff. I don't know if you guys ever did that. They don't let you do that now, but we used to just, driving down to like Myrtle Beach and we were kids. We'd never done this before. All of a sudden, hey, we're coming up to South Carolina. Dad would slam on the brakes. We'd pull off the side of the road. We'd all jump. and stand in front of the Welcome to South Carolina sign, and we take a picture. Now you can't do that. You get run over by the traffic and stuff. So don't do that stuff on that thing. But we don't have borders. And there's no capital city that you can go to. And there's no palace that you can go to and say, yeah, this is where Jesus sits. But Jesus Christ is King, and his subjects are those people who are his disciples. And those that Jesus, he rules in their hearts there. He takes that thing. Christ reigns in our hearts. He rules our actions, and he rules the men and women who have bowed their knees to God, dear God. So in this sermon, Jesus is giving his constitution for citizenship of his kingdom. And this is similar to Exodus 19, where Moses goes up to Mount Sinai to receive the law and comes down to give it to the people. And this is similar to that of Matthew, the fifth chapter, verse 1. Jesus goes up to a high place, a mountain, and the people are gathered around, and he starts to give them his law, his constitution for how we're going to be citizens. So if we want to be citizens in this kingdom, we're going to have the right heart. We need to be, right off the bat, poor in spirit. Again, on all these beatitudes, is that you don't pick and choose which beatitude you'd like. For citizenship in his kingdom, everybody does every one of these beatitudes. You got to have this kind of a heart there on that. You don't get to pick and choose. We all need to be poor in spirit. And again, stress that being blessed, the blessed here does not mean that you're happy. Blessed is just knowing that your actions are approved by God. That feeling that you have, God approves of what I'm doing. God is watching me. God is smiling upon me and stuff. And so, and in this case, the blessing is going to be a removal of the hindrances that keep us from being in this kingdom here and stuff. Poor in spirit. You got to be poor in spirit. Now, what this means is not, like some folks look at Luke, the sixth chapter and verse 20, where he just says, blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And they take it to mean, well, blessed are people that don't have a lot of money and stuff. But it's not talking about financially poor. So Matthew says poor in spirit. Luke says poor. And there's a lot of people that kind of look at the Bibles, and they use examples like this to say, hey, this Bible, it really contradicts itself. I don't think it's inspired. Because if these guys were inspired, Matthew would be saying the exact thing Luke's saying, word for word. Mark would have all of the signs and stuff that John has. Everything would be just the same thing all the way through it. And they fail to realize that we've got that these are kind of witness statements. My big thing on the patrol was handling traffic crashes. And crashes like big messes sometimes, and you're trying to figure out what happened. And a good source of finding out what happened is getting a witness statement. But your witness statements weren't always going to match up because people saw things from different views. One person would mention something that the other people would not mention. And you just, what you would do then is just you'd have to talk to everybody. You might have somebody following one of the cars. You might have somebody standing there getting gas and just looking. And I hated the traffic light crashes because what did everybody say? I had the green light. No, I had the green light. You know, oh, great. Who's got the light here and stuff? And it was always nice to talk to that guy at the gas station going, yeah, the red car had the red light there. And he blew that thing pretty good. Okay, that made it a lot easier and stuff. But you might have somebody telling you speeds. Somebody might tell you, here's a good one too. Somebody that didn't even see the crash happen come walking out of the store and saw one of the drivers getting out of the car on the left side. Because we always had a tendency on a lot of fatal crashes that the people that survived would go like, oh, I wasn't driving this car. And it was really nice to have somebody say, well, he got out of the driver's seat there when the dust was still settling. They go, okay, that didn't see anything of the crash, but it told us who the driver was. And so all the things, what I'm just saying is that when you're looking at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or looking at any of these, the Acts and that, says, you don't look at one statement and go like, that's the whole thing, encapsulated everything that was said was right there. You add up everything. So it's just as a traffic crash, you find out everybody's statement, you get them all together and it tells you what happened. You look at these things, what all happened here like this, to find out what was really said. That's you look at what Jesus said in Mark 16:16, which is different what he said there at the end of Matthew and stuff. It wasn't that he was saying something different. He was just saying they were only going to mention this one part that Jesus is saying. Also, something to consider here: how many times did Jesus give this sermon? Did he just give it the one time? Or did he give it a couple of times? You know, like in Luke, the 6th chapter, verse 17, he says that he went to a level place and on the plain and gave this sermon. I believe Jesus gave this sermon many, many times and stuff. He's not just going to give it one time. He's going to say things in a different way based on, I think, of who he's talking to and stuff. So we want to know what the blessed are the poor is, we just add these together to give us the answer there. So Jesus is not speaking about people that are financially poor. And certainly money, though, can hinder us in being Christians there. If we look, you know, in 1 Timothy 6, it's just talking about, you know, that the person that strives to be rich falls into snares and temptations. You know, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. You know, people that just love money and wealth can set themselves in for a hard fall. I think what Jesus said, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle than a rich man to enter into heaven. When you're carrying all that wealth with you, sometimes it's hard to let go of that stuff. It's serving me really well. I think it serves me better than God does, and it gets in the way. But there, it is not, just because you're rich doesn't mean you're excluded from being in this kingdom here. We look in the Bible, there's many godly men that have been rich. Abraham was rich. Job was rich. He was rich at the start of the book, had a hard time in the middle of the book. At the end, he was richer than what he started out with. David was rich. Cornelius was rich. But we're not talking about here about what your bank account looks like. Nor is being poor in spirit speaking about someone who lacks self-confidence. He's just down on himself, got a low opinion of himself. You know, he's getting interviewed for a job. And the HR guy's going like, why should we hire you? And my answer would be, well, I don't know why you'd hire me. I bet you'd find some people way better than me. I'm not that good. It's not talking like that kind of poor in spirit there. You're not a doormat. We look at David when he's facing Goliath there in 1 Samuel 17. And it's the first, I think, recorded incidence of trash talking being done before a battle and stuff. Goliath is saying, you know, I'm gonna kill you here and stuff, and the animals are going to be eating your carcass and stuff. And David's saying, like, you know, he says, God's going to deliver you into my hands. And David comes, you know, not even standing still. He's running toward Goliath. And it's his attitude is not like, well, I'll probably get killed. Maybe I'll get a lucky shot. I don't know. I just, you know, I'm really down on myself. No, he says, David, I put down David as a Jack Russell Terrier with a sling. He's this little guy. He's going to go. He's going to take this big old guy on. He's after him. There's no like lack of confidence and lack of, you know, thinking poorly about themselves. He's strong there. He's ready to go. So it's not thinking poorly of ourselves, having a bad attitude about ourselves, but poor in spirit means thinking properly, not weak-minded or being nervous or no confidence. Being poor in spirit is not having a prideful heart, is what he's talking about. Being having this heart of pride in myself. You ever seen those westerns, whatever? And they talk about the guy goes, hey, watch this horse, now it's a spirited thoroughbred. What is it? Why do they call it spirited? Because it throws everybody that tries to get on it, and it bites people, and then, you know, like you got to. it doesn't want to get rid. It doesn't want to agree, and it's going to fight you. It's going to, the old Bronco thing is going to throw all the riders and stuff. Or it's probably more he's talking about like he's not, more like the stubborn mule is what you're dealing with there and stuff. Yeah, you know, let's go to an example of this in Luke. Let's go to Luke the 18th chapter. And we're looking about this, you know, being poor in spirit and what a clash is. We're looking in Luke 18 and we're looking in verse 9. And he says, and he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. And the Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes to all I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So the Pharisees, his prayer to God was, boy, I'm glad I'm not this guy, because I'm doing really good stuff. You see the prideful heart there on this. You know, we have to be careful of this ourselves and stuff. If we look in Ephesians, the second chapter, and he's just talking about, you know, how we are saved. Ephesians, the second chapter, and in verse 8, he says, for by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. You don't want to get into that argument when we're talking about people, about whether you need to be baptized to be saved. You do, but when we shy away from verses like this. It says, yes, we are saved by grace. It's not anything that I did that saved me. It was following God's directions, following Christ's directions that got me saved. But I'm saved by grace. But the prideful person goes, well, I'm saved by grace, but I didn't need a lot of grace. I mean, I'm pretty close to God. Now, that's this guy down here, this tax collector. He needs a lot of grace, but I don't need a lot of grace. I just want to kind of point that out. No, we need a lot of grace there. We're not anywhere close to what God is, and we've fallen, any type of sin, we have fallen woefully short that stuff. So we're looking at that pride getting in the way of us that we can't follow God. You know, we're looking at other people with contempt. There's just so much pride there. And we can also, you know, exalt ourselves in thought as well as speaking this thing, how we're thinking all the time on this stuff. So being poor in spirit, though, is this. Being poor in spirit is spiritual bankruptcy. To realize that I'm a sinner. To realize that I'm falling short of the glory of God. That's Romans 3:23. And to realize that I'm the one that's failed. That I am weak on this thing. And that it's my fault that I am a sinner and have fallen short of the glory of God. God doesn't owe me anything. God didn't cause this. I'm the one that did this thing. And I am just woefully in need of grace. I'm in need of love. I'm in need of mercy. And I'm in need of salvation. And God is the only one who can help me with this thing. So, to having this attitude of being poor in spirit, let's go to the book of Isaiah. And Isaiah gives us a ton of little examples of this. Isaiah, the 41st chapter of Isaiah. We're looking at being poor in spirit here. Isaiah 41 in verse 17. It says, the poor and needy seek water, but there is none. Their tongues fail for thirst. I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers and desolate heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I don't think Isaiah is talking about some people that are in the midst of a drought. He's talking about people that are spiritually just dried up. And they are in desperate need of spiritual water. Remember when Jesus talking to the woman at the well, and he says, I got water that you'll never thirst again. And she's asking, now, where do I get that? Where is this well that I can get that? You know, Jesus is the source of that. We're dehydrated out, and he's the source of that spiritual water. There's another one in Isaiah, the 57th chapter. Isaiah 57 and verse 15. Verse 15. For thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. You know, when we commit sin and we're not really sorry about it, we're not contrite. If it doesn't bother us, that's what God is looking at. You're not bothered by it, then you're not sorry for it. A contrite person, when you realize, hey, I really sinned and I have really messed up my life on this thing. That's what God wants to associate with the humble and the contrite. Somebody that's realizes their mistakes, realizes their sin, realizes they have no hope for salvation. They're sorry for it, and they just desperately need God to help them through this thing. That's who he's looking for. We'll go there in Isaiah, the 61st chapter, 61. This is a speech that Jesus gives. It's a reading that Jesus gives in the synagogue that got him in so much trouble there in Luke 4:18 there. So, but Isaiah 61 in verse 1, it says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, the day of vengeance of our God, and to comfort all who mourn. So looking at that thing, he's not, again, talking about the physical ailments and that. Even though Jesus heals people and stuff, he's not talking about, you know, somebody that's hurt and or in a jail or that kind of thing, but that's spiritually, you're in jail. Spiritually, you're broken. And he has come to help those out, to have that in verse 1 there. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, the contrite person that's, you know, you're just lost. You don't know what to do there and stuff. You know, you don't have this attitude, see here, of this idea of what's in it for me. I'll be a Christian, but God, you owe me, and you need to bail me out because I'm going to do this stuff, but you better be coming through for me. That's not the attitude that the person that's poor in spirit has. It says you're completely lost. It's more of the, well, what should I do here? I've jumped ahead. Let's go back to Isaiah, the 6th chapter. We see the attitude that we're supposed to be having. You know, not this, what's in it for me, God? What am I got to do? What's the least amount of things that I have to do? What's the bottom line? How far before you don't accept me and stuff? But it's the opposite. We look there in Isaiah, the 6th chapter, and in verse 1, he says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had 6 wings. But with 2 he covered his face, and with 2 he covered his feet, and with 2 he flew. And one cried to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the doors were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. Just imagine, again, you know, how close am I to God? We are very far away with these entities saying about what God is, and the place is shaking. So I said, woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King and the Lord of hosts. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a live coal, which he had taken with the tongs of the altar, and he touched my mouth with it and said, behold, this has touched your lips. Your iniquity is taken away and your sin is purged. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send and whom will go for us? Then I said, Here am I, send me. That's the attitude that we're to be taken. You know, I'm lost. What do you want me to do, God? And I'm going to do everything that you're going to have me do. That's what I'm going to do. That's that spirit that's saying, it's not my will be done, but your will. You know, we sing that tune, He Leadeth Me. In one of the choruses, it says, His faithful servant I would be. Faithful here doesn't mean you believe. Faithful is you're dependable. You're going to do what you say you're going to do and stuff. 1 Timothy 1:15, it talks like that. This is a faithful saying. It doesn't mean that the saying is believing in God. It's just saying you can depend on these sayings and stuff. So the idea is that, you know, the position is going to be, where do you want me, Lord? What do you want me to do? And I'm not going to be fighting God anymore like the spirited horse trying to buck God off of me in some way. I don't want to get dealing with this. I got my own spirit and stuff. I need to be closer to God. I'm not going to be fighting Him. It's a spirit of trust and not of fear either. So God knows the right ways to realize. I realize that God knows the right way. If we go to 1 John, the 5th chapter, 1 John 5 and 3, He says, This is the love of God that you keep His commandments, and His commandments are not burdensome. He doesn't give you commandments to put you through some kind of weird test that you don't have to go through and to suffer and stuff. He's given you these commandments because they are best for us. They work. And I've always done that stuff. People, you know, I don't know if you've had that. It's like, you know, you've done simple activity and you got friends that realize you did simple activity. And then you become a Christian and they're going, hey, you used to do that sinful activity. And that's their statement. I said, you're asking the wrong question. I said, well, the question you should be asking, hey, Mick, did that work for you? At the end of all the trouble that you had, I said, that was a great thing. That was the best thing I ever did in my life. No, I don't say that. Do I say, you know, folks, you ought to follow that too. Kids, you ought to be doing that stuff that we used to do. I said, no, we don't say that because he said it didn't work. It caused us all kinds of trouble. So Jesus and God giving us commandments, He's not putting us through work that we don't need to do. He's saying, hey, you're going to be happy if you do this. You're going to be more content if you do this. You're going to be satisfied. You're going to be healed if you do this kind of stuff. He's wiser than us, and He's concerned about my best interest there. Matthew 23, verse 37, Jesus was just talking about Israel and Judah, and He just said, you know, oh, Jerusalem, you know, how I would have just gathered you together like a hen covers up her chicks to protect you, but you would not do this and stuff. He knows what's best for me. He's not trying to hurt me. And God's way is going to save me in the end here and stuff. But if we're going to have that strong spirit like the mule, and we're just going to sit down and we're not going to move, He ain't going to budge us then. And if we think we're equal with God and we're on par with Him, then we're going to fail. You know, it's that idea like, you know, God is bigger, but I'm closer. You know, I see the stuff around me is closer to me and stuff. So that's more important. And that's going to set myself up for failures. So being poor in spirit is recognizing that I am in need. And it needs to be a feeling that's deep inside all of us. Not just saying it, yeah, I'm poor in spirit and stuff. But, you know, you got to be feeling these things. I don't have any way of getting out of this thing other than by with God there. It's not an attribute of some super Christian. We always think about that, like the apostles or something. I heard a comedian talking about. He said people that are oversaved. We have at church they get people they call oversaved. You know, like so you'd be talking to them after service and going, yeah, I can't find my keys to my car. And he goes, well, you should be more interested in the keys of the kingdom. And I'm like, all right, okay, like. Talking like that stuff, that they do this super type stuff and stuff. No, he says it's an attribute to every Christian, every person that's going to be in Jesus' kingdom. You have to have this attitude. So it's a way of invitation. I always ask these people, police officers, I talk to military guys, because I've known this happen, I just say, hey, how's your spirit doing? I was doing it a lot of times with you folks. Like, how's your spirit doing? Because you're getting knocked down, you're getting ripped up and stuff, and how do you feel and stuff on that, you know? It may not hit you all at one time. Sometimes we just, like the straw that breaks the camel's back, just little things added all the time, and then it wears you down there. But, you know, it's if you're poor spiritually, that's when God can help us. And that's, and he's always wanting us to be that. Just in that position, get rid of all that garbage, that pride in that, and just accept what God wants us to do. So we offer this as an invitation. You know, again, it's just a great time to do this. This isn't the only time that you need to come forward or to seek help. There's a lot of folks that kind of go like, you're only allowed to talk about to anybody at the end of Sunday morning services or Sunday evening, and the rest of the week you're on your own. No, you make those phone calls, you talk to somebody, and to leave that open. But we offer it any way that we can help, whether you haven't been baptized or whether you've kind of fallen away or you're just going through some tough times and you need some prayers and stuff. We're here to help you out with whatever way we can. So come forward while we'll stand and sing our song of invitation.